Science and Health's 10th chapter, Science of Being. Gordon Brown, London, January 1975.
Well, what a spiritually mighty chapter it is, isn't it? And 72 pages long, which means that in attempting to sum up our study of it, we certainly won't be able to touch on every paragraph or let our thought flow conscientiously from capitalized term to capitalized term, as of course we can do, and which indeed is the main purpose of the study itself. So let's just feel our way as deeply as we're able at the moment into the depths of the chapter itself, into the spiritual essence of the teaching as a whole. Let's try to feel our way just into the main theme of it, or if you like, the divine thread of it, so that that's what sings out of the text to us. See, the science, that is to say the truth, the true knowledge, the understanding of what everything in our world, our universe, is timelessly being, here and everywhere, now and forever. Because this is going to enable us, isn't it, in the chapter's closing pages to stand together on what is called the platform of divine metaphysics, so that we begin to survey our world from this standpoint. And in the next chapter, that's the 11th chapter, to be able to answer its apparent objections to its own God identity appearing in Christian Science. And then, as a result of that, to be able to enter upon the healing practice of Christian Science in the 12th chapter, which really is the only thing that truly teaches Christian Science, isn't it, in the 13th chapter. But didn't we, in fact, find ourselves standing on a platform, that is to say, on a certain mountaintop, at the end of the 8th chapter, Footsteps of Truth? Yes, we did. On what the text there calls the Horeb height, where God is revealed. Where it's no longer a question of being told objectively, God is, God is, God is, but where we begin to hear the infinite itself, the selfhood of all of us, voicing subjectively, I am, I am, I am. Now, as a result of that, do we not also, by textual implication, find ourselves standing on another mountain at the end of the 9th chapter, Creation? Yes, the Mount of Transfiguration. See, the divine revelation of what the I Am truly is, revealing itself, can't fail to transfigure us and change us humanly, can it? It just can't fail. Now, at the end, on the last page of Footsteps of Truth, you remember where it says, absolute Christian science, the implication is this, may possibly be achieved prior to the change called death. That's what we are encouraged to hope on the last page of Footsteps of Truth. How? Well, by letting what I, God, am, that is to say, life itself and not death, do the changing. Which, of course, we get throughout the ninth chapter, creation. So that at the end of that chapter, it says to us, even in this world, don't for goodness sake wait for the next, even in this world, let thy garments be always white. That means white and glistering like the raiment of Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. Now, of course, Christian science itself is always absolute, isn't it? It couldn't possibly be otherwise. If, when just the term Christian science without the word absolute is used in the text, we see there Christian science solving the problem of dualism. It couldn't possibly be other than absolute all the time. But the term or the phrase absolute Christian science is used throughout the textbook in relation to what is called the resurrection. That is to say, when the last mortal enemy, death, is overcome. And therefore, when the whole problem of dualism is in fact solved. But the thing is that resurrection is exactly the same standpoint as transfiguration. The difference being that with transfiguration there isn't a preliminary crucifixion. And therefore, the three tabernacles of a past, a present, and a future which Peter, James, and John wanted to build for Moses, Jesus, and Elias, that whole thing has yielded to being, to timeless being. Everything in the universe spiritually contemporaneous with everything else. And of course it's only that unity of all things with all things in the here and the now that is the Father's beloved Son in whom he is well pleased, isn't it so? So when we get to the end of the 10th chapter, this present chapter, The Science of Being, we find ourselves standing on the platform of divine metaphysics. Now, are there really three different platforms or three different mountaintops? No, not really. There's only the one. And in divine science, of course, it is this platform that we get to at the end of the chapter. So it's really a question of dear God, dear Christ, dear world-transforming, world-healing, world-transfiguring, revelation, I am. Everything is being. Mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. Let us be more and more and more aware of this reality. So, if we turn then to page 268 in the textbook, at the opening of the chapter, we can start. And we start with that Bible verse from the first epistle of John the Revelator, on which, of course, the whole chapter is based, isn't it? So let's start there. 268, the opening of the chapter. What is he saying here? That which is being, that which is timelessly from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled, of the word of life, the tone of the word. What is being referred to? Of course, it's Jesus, isn't it? Jesus is total solution of the problem of being, the problem of duality, as a fait accompli. Now, it's happened. It is. It's being. Now, if we could we just see where it is within the structure of the book as a whole that is presented to us? This that Jesus has totally accomplished, which we have handled, which we've seen, which before our eyes, as it were, where does it come? Within the four square structure of the book as a whole. It's really the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, isn't it? And if we were just to look at the matrix card and see the chapters in relation to the 16 tones of the matrix card, we would find ourselves at the beginning of this second row of the Christ tones, wouldn't we? Here, the word as the Christ, Atonement and Eucharist. That's where it's presented to us as having happened before our eyes, as it were. Now on then, that which we have seen and heard, declare we unto you. That's the tone of the Christ itself, isn't it? And where in the textbook do we find all that Jesus stands for, all that Jesus has accomplished, presented as that which is possible for each one of us? In the sixth chapter, Science, Theology, Medicine, as we come across this second row of the Christ tones here, to the tone of the Christ as the Christ, where all that Atonement and Eucharist means is made available to each one of us through the discovery and revelation of Christian Science. That which we have seen and heard, declare we unto you. Now thirdly, that ye also may have fellowship with us, the tone of Christianity. And where is this fellowship in the textbook so pronounced? It's in this present chapter, The Science of Being, where the main tone of it is Christianity as the Christ, coming across this horizontal to the third tone there. Christianity as the Christ. It's everything in being in relation to everything else as one being. The relationship of everything, Christianity, in its total oneness, that's Christ. Christianity as the Christ. And that's what the science of being is. So that fourthly, and truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. See, it's all taken back to God there, all taken back to the principle, all found within the principle, the tone of science itself. So this beautiful little verse comes through the word Christ, Christianity, science, which in the matrix chart would take us across to the chapter we haven't got to yet, but which is recapitulation. You see, you can feel it coming where principle and its idea is one. Truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. Yes, yes, yes. So it's on this four-square platform of the word, the Christ, Christianity, science, that we stand. And we can't do otherwise, because it just is. It's just what being is, and nothing can be done about it. All we can do is to come into line with it, so help me God. Amen. It's so be it. It is so. If you like, this is it. All right, then on those two quotations, the chapter is based, and we come to the actual text. And as we remember, the text for the first, I think it's about 2.5 pages, bases us on the simple theme of the chapter as a whole, the simple proposition that in fact there is only one being. To the senses, it looks as if there are two beings running side by side, but that's impossible. You can entertain the thought of either or, if you like, and choose the wrong, but wisdom says choose the right, but what is impossible is to have both. It's either or, but the truth is the science of being itself. And how is that going to become real to us? How are we going to begin to understand that? Well, just think for a moment, says the text, of the material world, what looks like material world on the one hand, and what looks like the realm of the real on the other, because in the material world, thought has seemed to bring to light with such rapidity all these wonders. But simultaneously, thought, the same thing, thought, swift pinions, have been rising towards the realm of the real. And if we push our inquiries deep enough and far enough, what we find is that there is in fact a single spiritual cause for both. Now, if this is so, then clearly a great change of base is taking place. And that change is from a material basis from which to deduce things and arrive at conclusions, being changed to a metaphysical basis. And that metaphysical basis of everything is, on line 9 there, what is meant by the term mind as the cause of every effect. The metaphysical basis of everything is mind, capital M, as the cause of every effect, fundamentally, whether you're looking at what the senses declare or at the revelation of truth itself. And therefore, it's no wonder that historically we are in the middle of a revolutionary struggle. It's the struggle between what appears as physics on the one hand and metaphysics on the other hand. Physics, in the text here, is represented by the giant Goliath, because that's the name in the Bible that means exile from God, and he's physics, whereas metaphysics is represented by David, the shepherd boy with his sling, which today is everything that is meant by the term woman, the womanhood of God. Woman goes forth to battle with Goliath. And it's a final struggle for supremacy. They're meeting in final combat. Physics and metaphysics meeting in final combat. And the thing is, says the text, semi-metaphysics is no use. It's no aid whatever to divine metaphysics in this combat. Because in the story in the Bible, of course, it's semi-metaphysics is Saul, isn't it, who offered David the sword and the spear, which would have put David on the same footing as Goliath himself, and David has to refuse this. Semi-metaphysics, no substantial aid to scientific metaphysics, because their arguments are based on this mixture, this supposed mingling of good and evil, mind and matter. That is of no use whatever in this struggle of metaphysics with physics. In fact, this mingling of good and evil, says the text on page 269, now line 5, is just the philosophy of the serpent. See, that serpent is going to feature so interestingly later on, isn't it, when Moses throws down his rod and it becomes a serpent. And it's perfectly clear that you haven't got a choice, really. It looks as if there are two things, but never at the same time. It's either a serpent or a rod, but never the two things at the same time. And that's the teaching here regarding divine metaphysics on the one hand and physics on the other. This philosophy of the serpent is simply human philosophy, because it would make God like man. It would make God man-like. Whereas divine philosophy, on the other hand, divine wisdom. See, it's the difference between the wisdom of God and the so-called wisdom of the serpent. Divine philosophy, or Christian science, makes man godlike. And divine philosophy, Christian science, is divine metaphysics, as we have it in the marginal heading there. And matter simply doesn't enter into metaphysical premises or conclusions. And so interestingly here, isn't it, this big scientific term of the categories is used in relation to divine metaphysics. The categories or classifications of relationships in the science of being, everything related, properly classified, in their true categories, all resting on one basis, the divine mind, all stemming from one mind. This is the truth about the science of our being, is that all our relationships stem or rest upon the basis of this one divine mind. Because in that case, you see, metaphysics, having resolved things into thoughts, it exchanges what looks like the objects of sense for the ideas of soul. Because in soul, you can't have subject cut off from object. You can't have two things, a me here and a you there, an us and a them, and so on. the ideas of soul, in which subject and object are one, is the very essence, I think, don't you, of this, of the teachings of this chapter, instead of subject here, object there. And look how this is the very basis of the whole of the Bible, the foundations on which the whole Bible is built, the teachings of Jesus, of his apostles, of the prophets, because this is the science of one mind, the science of being, divine metaphysics. This system of divinely classified, categorized ideas, the science of mind, the only foundations for us to build on, in fact, the rock itself, line 28. And therefore, the woman, what is she doing? She's combating these two things. One, that all is matter, and secondly, that matter originates in mind and is as real as mind, and one is just as bad as the other. There's no more truth in the one than in the other. So we turn over to page 270 and find the simplicity of it all, that either everything is mind, or secondly, that everything is matter. Sorry, that's the wrong order as it's put here. One, that everything is matter. Two, that everything is mind. And the great thing is, which is it? Because we can't have both, because they're opposites. And on line 6, therefore, both cannot be real. There is but one power, not two powers, matter and mind. There is but one intelligence, on line 11, governing the universe. And that is divine mind. And instantly we must see that this idea of one mind is our principle. This is our governing principle. And of course, being one mind, that principle must be love. So it just doesn't leave us with an abstract intellectual concept of mind. It says that this mind is divine principle, love. And that as such, what we are concerned with, this is line 16, is a new dispensation of truth, because this is what truth is. This is truth, and it's the new dispensation of truth which the prophets foresaw. They foresaw it coming, but they didn't see it in its science. They weren't able to estimate it in its infinite meanings. They weren't able to see it as omnipotence itself, and therefore they weren't able to see it maintaining the science of spirit, because that's what it is, this new dispensation of truth, which is the science of mind, the divine principle love, never two things but only one thing. Therefore, it is the science of spirit, isn't it? And as such, on line 23, it's Christ. This is Christ, this new dispensation of truth. And it's Christ as the principle, the Christ principle of this world, this present world of ours. Love, one mind, is the Christ principle of this world, in contrast to the pride of priesthood as the prince of this world. See, it's never two things. You can't have both. You can either have the pride of priesthood as prince of this world, or you can have one mind, and that mind love, as the principle of this world. One with its meekness and charity and divine authority, and the other with its arrogance and claiming to be a channel through which you can get to God. You can get to God through me. God speaks through me, and I can connect you with God. But that's Goliath. That involves Goliath, which is the exile sense, you see. Whereas the woman says nothing of the sort. Everything is in instant communion with its divine source, and this is Christ. Christ is where everything is in instant communion. But priesthood says you've got to get it through me, and it's got to come through me, and I'll do the connecting for you. And of course, that's basically sin, because it's the sin of separation or the sin of exile. And only when we see Christ, on line 26, through these two colossal terms, truth and love, like this, do we see the answer to the sin of separation, because truth and love say no separation. In truth, there is no separation of manhood, the manhood of God, from the womanhood of God, and that in love is the manhood and womanhood of God, one with God. Instant communication, instant at-one-ment. And so truth and love unmakes sinners. Sin makes sinners, truth and love unmakes them. Now what the text is talking about, you see, is on the bottom line there, line 32, is spirituality. It's the science of spirit. It's spirituality. Spirituality is the state of being spiritual. And being spiritual is being constituted of spirit. And therefore, it's the science of spirit with its spirituality, which in the case of Jesus is so natural, so utterly, utterly natural. His life and his life work is indigenous to this spirituality. It doesn't have to be fabricated in any way. It's just natural. This spirituality is the good soil wherein the seed of his life and the seed of your and my life that then grows and fructifies, wherein it's indigenous, isn't it? The seed of truth springs up in this that is meant by spirituality, the science of spirit, and bears much fruit. But it can't possibly just be true for Jesus. See, the life of Christ Jesus must become the life of Christ's Christianity. It must be true for all mankind in relationship. This indigenous quality of spirituality, so that as the chain of scientific being, where everything in the science of being is linked with everything else, well, you can see it, how it is just coming all the way through the Bible, is what the scriptures are all about, isn't it? And how it unites all the so-called thousand-year periods of the Bible, the time sense, takes away the time sense, and unites them all into one timeless design, the design of God in which everything is contemporaneous with everything else. So it's true, this life, for all mankind. And there just isn't any, it's divine science, this. Divine science on line 6, wherein the human and the divine are in instant communication. Nothing in between. Human never exiled from the divine. And of course there's no emasculation, there's no lack of seed. No emasculation, no illusion, no insubordination. no rebellion of man against his principle. Now what is the text about to tell us? It's really, really distinguishing between what is true for Jesus and what seems to be true for the disciples. You see, for Jesus, it's utterly, utterly natural. It's all indigenous. You can't stop it. But in the case of the disciples, the seed has to be sown. And so he instructed his disciples, 271, line 7. He instructed them, and the disciples became learners. On line 13, they cultivated and they cultured this seed within them, which is the seed of spiritual understanding. They cultivated the spiritual understanding of this divine science. And it was seen to be universal in its application, true for everybody, because what is the seed that Jesus sowed when he instructed them? It's the seed of the truth that it doesn't really have to be sown, that it's already there. That's the seed that is sown, the seed of understanding that it is as indigenous to you, to you, to you, to you, to you, to man as a whole, as to Jesus. But that has to be sown, that seed, isn't it so? And then you feel it, you see, being true when for everybody when it comes to the Comforter. That's the Comforter that shall teach you, instruct you in all things, that you are it already. And that's the science of Christianity on line 21, leading into all truth, into eternal life. So are we willing to leave the personal way of going to work, leave our nets and the belief that I've got a hotline to God and God talks through me and so on? Are we really willing to leave that and go for truth itself, cast our net on the right side for truth itself? Because it's what the scriptures are all about. It's what the word on line 30 of the scriptures is all about. And this is what the people will hear. But there's got to be a preacher. He's got to preach the word. But he'll only preach the word if it's the Christ, if he's sent, word Christ. And in that case, multitudes will be healed, because the people will be hearing science. Multitudes will be healed in Christianity because the people will be hearing science. So you get this lovely word Christ, Christianity, science coming here. And it's the spiritual sense of truth uncapitalized, the seed of truth capitalized. That's what it is. It's the spiritual sense of this seed within us that is capable of opening out and bearing such fruit. So the spiritual sense of truth has to be gained before truth itself, capitalized, can be understood. And says the text, don't let's kid ourselves, because this can only possibly happen in the measure that these qualities are present, these spiritual qualities wherein the seed of truth is indigenous. And these qualities are the qualities of being honest, unselfish, loving, and meek. It's the soil of an honest and good heart wherein the seed has got to be sown, because it's already there in that soil. It's indigenous to that soil. And so, coming down that page 272, we know in the Bible, so in the New Testament, so much importance is given to the sower. It's the sower at work, sowing the seed, which in fact is already indigenous. The seed of all that the opening pages mean. One mind, not two. That mind, divine principle, love. That's what truth is. This is the science of spirit. Therefore, this is spirituality. It's the seed of this that the sower sows. And the result, of course, is this spiritualization of thought and Christianization of daily life. Chastity, purity instead of sensualism, impurity, showing that the thing is of divine origin. Right? Is that what it's saying? And then at the bottom of 272, you see it really comes to a little climax because, well, in that case, it's just God that's doing it and not persons at all. All that is going on then with us now, here, everywhere, is the divine principle of the universe interpreting the universe. This is Christian Science. This is what Jesus demonstrated. And over to 273, because in this case, you see, the problem of being will solve. This will solve the problem of being on line 6, because it's the divine principle of divine science interpreting itself, voicing itself. We're deducing everything from this principle. Every conclusion is being deduced from this principle, not from material hypotheses. And in that case, this is real science, because this is fundamental law that we are concerned with. The law, the divine law, that it must be the principle interpreting its own universe, and nothing to do with persons or priests or the prince of this world. It's just woman, the womanhood of man, in her absolute unity and at one-ment with her divine source that's at work. Well, of course this law is the law on line 10 there of the reversal of the evidence of the material senses, science versus sense in the marginal heading, where man, on line 18, is governed by soul. This law, reversing the evidence of the senses, reveals man governed by soul, because subject and object to him are one in identity under this law, contrary to the evidence of the senses, which say they're cut apart. And this is the spiritual law in the margin at the bottom there, which is the only law, the law of the supremacy of spirit, whereby Jesus walked on the waves, fed the multitude, and so on, in demonstration of science. How different from all this mortal mind stuff at the bottom of the page, this atmosphere of mortal mind. How different is science from all these material, conflicting, mortal opinions, which are just a miasma, a mental miasma. And Christian Science is the antidote to it. Christian Science, as truth and love on the first line there, the science part of it is truth, but the Christian part of it is love. Christian Science, truth and love, antidoting this miasma of conflicting opinions and everything broken up and in a state of disarray. It's all unnecessary, all due to unnecessary knowledge gained from the five senses. Whereas the law that we're concerned with here is the law of the reversal of the evidence of the five senses. So that instead of everything being the offspring of sense on line five, it's the offspring of soul, spirit. And that's what natural science really is. The science of ideas born of spirit. And we come down into that remarkable paragraph starting line 12, do you remember? Where the five senses deceptive, it says in the margin. Because what about the senses? You see, the senses, man's senses, the senses are the senses of spirit, and they must abide in love. Our senses mustn't come away from love. Because if they stay in love, then they'll demonstrate truth, they'll demonstrate wholeness, no departure, no breakup, and that will demonstrate deathlessness, they'll demonstrate life, no division. So the senses must abide in love. And then we've got science expounding Christianity in that case, says the text. Because we've got spiritual understanding, and that science expounding the relationships of all things to all things as seen through the senses of spirit, abiding in love and demonstrating truth and life. Science expounding Christianity. Because look what happens if we take the senses, the idea of the senses, which are the senses of spirit, and start to say they're five, and start to say they're physical, erroneously term the five physical senses. Of course they get misdirected in that case and are simply the manifest beliefs of mortal mind. But if we see that in fact they remain forever the senses of spirit, and that even if you, like if it was a white object and you looked at it through a piece of blue glass, it would not be in fact a blue object, but the blue sense of that object would be under the absolute control of the white reality of it. So the senses, when they're seen to be the senses of spirit, are in control of what temporally seems to us as material sense. Because you see, there aren't two. There can't be both. And this is the teaching as the chapter begins to get underway. Which means to say that it's divine science, God and man one, human and divine one in coincidence, is absolute. There's nothing outside. There's nothing cut off or outside. It's all within the orbits of the principle. No halfway position, no semi-metaphysics, only divine metaphysics on the one hand, and therefore the nothingness of physics on the other. No partnership, co-partnership of matter and mind. This suppositional partnership is already obsolete, for matter examined in the light of divine metaphysics, where all is mind, disappears. There aren't two. So, as we turn over to page 275, you see we've got a starting point. This is all leading up to what the starting point is. It's mind. The starting point of divine science, this is divine science, with its start and its starting point, is that God, Spirit, is all in all. There's no other might nor mind. And just to make sure we don't get intellectual about it, this mind must be love, and as soon as it's love, it's seen to be divine principle. come again, you see, the same idea is reiterated. And so what we are beginning to do is to grasp the reality and order of being in its science. The science of being itself, beginning by reckoning God as the divine principle interpreting its own universe of all that really is. What is this principle? According to the Bible, it's spirit. Jolly well is only the one spirit. What is spirit? Spirit is life, truth, love. That's what constitutes this great concept of being called spirit. This is what the principle is. Spirit, which is life, truth, and love. All these capitalized divine synonyms for God. But look at this paragraph. Because in this paragraph, not only the divine capitalized synonyms are there, but all the uncapitalized terms are there too. All substance, all intelligence, wisdom, being, all uncapitalized, immortality, cause and effect, belong to the capitalized. All belong to God and to his attributes, manifestations, so that wisdom must be God's wisdom in order to be wise. Truth has to be God's truth in order to be true. Love, little l, little t, has to be God's love in order to be lovely. And life, uncapitalized life, has to be life, capitalized, in order to be life. And good has to be God's good in order to be good. This is divine metaphysics. And it's revealing itself, says the text on line 21 there, 275-21, is revealing itself to spiritual understanding, showing clearly that all, little a, everything uncapitalized is found in the capitalized. The reality of it is the capitalized itself. All power, all presence, all science, hence all, is in reality the manifestation of mind. Well, what's the result? Come over to 276, and of course it's universal brotherhood. How could it be otherwise? This is the science of being. Christianity as the Christ in the matrix structure of the textbook as a whole, the science of being chapter. Having. It all belongs to God, and we haven't got it. God's got it. But having one God, one mind, is that which heals. It's that which pays the captive's ransom. Because it says to him, you've never been exiled. You've never been a captive. You're in instant and immediate communication with your divine source. And so, because of this one mind, everything is a state of universal brotherhood, and therefore your ransom is paid. And this is the foundation, therefore, of fellowship, one mind not at war with another, because all have one spirit, one intelligent source. This is the mind of Jesus. The mind that was in Christ Jesus, man and his maker, correlated in divine science, the human and the divine, in instant communication. And this is harmony, isn't it? Harmony in man, just as you get harmony in music. This is the music of man, the music of universal brotherhood, the music of true fellowship, the harmony of it. So as we come down that page to line 19, what we're doing is to learn in science to be perfect as the Father in heaven is perfect. Because all the discord is the nothingness of error, but harmony is the somethingness of truth. And another topic comes in at the bottom of that 276, all on this subject of the great law, the divine law and the spiritual laws of the science of being. And here this law is represented as the law of like, always producing like. It can't possibly produce its opposite. Like must always be producing like. And therefore everything that is unlike mind has got to die, shall surely die. And dust, as dust it returns to dust. Are we coming down that page now, 277, to the middle, where we see, you see that like not only produces like in divine metaphysics, but it also reproduces like. See, mind produces its likeness in man, and that likeness, that image, that idea is the reproduction of the original. So it reproduces like, and even in nature, you see, this order of genus and species is preserved everywhere throughout the entire round of nature, whereas error would claim to reverse it and say that spirit produces matter, which makes matter, therefore, simply an error of statement. And if you have it in the premise, you'll have it in the conclusion of everything we think and everything we do, because what is true in the premise will go right the way through to the conclusion. And so our premise or our starting point has got to be this one mind, and then the conclusion will always be in accord with that premise. Spirit. You see, what the text is now, the topic, what becomes now, substance. Substance, what is substance? This like-producing like develops into the theme of substance, because substance, this is what substance is, spirit, not matter. Come over to 279 at the top there, where you see these contrasting qualities. Do we want the erring, changing, and dying, the mutable and mortal, those qualities, or the unerring, immutable, and immortal, those substantial qualities? Faith, for example, says on line 4, is a quality of mind, and is the substance, faith is the substance of things hoped for. But what's the good of that? The science of being isn't a question of things hoped for, it's what is being, not what we're hoping for. And therefore the science of being deals with the substance of what is now, and that spirit. The great quality of mind, capital M. Spirit is what mind is constituted of. All the qualities of spirit are the basic constitution of this mind that we're talking about, namely ideas on line 11, which are therefore tangible and real. So, quality, you know, from qualis, how constituted. Mind is constituted of spirit's qualities as its own subjective condition, so that ideas are tangible and real. And down to line 19, where spirit is reached only through the understanding and demonstration of eternal life and truth and love. This is what spirit is, eternal life and truth and love. So we can only touch on these things in attempting to sum up what we found when we studied the chapter in much greater detail. And come up to page 280 then, because their mind, being infinite, begins to handle this whole belief that it's compressed into a brain, a little brain, and percolates through a little brain. The infinite cannot percolate through the finite. The infinite is forever infinite, and mind remains forever infinite, and the mind of each one of us is infinite, the one mind, and therefore it isn't a question of having it bottled up into a brain, because if it were so, then you would get mind broken up into minds, says the text, doesn't it? And you'd get soul and substance all divided up, and spirit would be divided into persons and souls, and you'd get God's many and Lord's many, whereas the great thing is you mustn't have God's many and Lord's many. You shall have no other gods before the one, the me. So it isn't a question, it's the serpent that argues, ye shall be as gods. That this infinite soul is imprisoned in mortal body, and spirit and life imprisoned in finite forms. You see, body isn't sentient. Body isn't sentient, it's mind. The soul itself that is sentient, that's where all sensibility lies, not in the body. God, the soul of man, that's where all sensibility lies, in our soul, which is our mind, not in body. And so, soul perpetuates its own qualities, individuality, harmony, immortality, imparts and perpetuates these qualities in us, in man, but through mind. Through our mind, through our God mind, these qualities are imparted. And so what are we doing on the top of page 281? We're entering into the kingdom of truth on earth and learning that spirit is infinite and supreme. And you come, therefore, to this great note that's being struck now on page 281 about the ego. God and man have the same ego. God is the ego of man. He's the mind of man, the soul of man, the life of man. Therefore, he must be the ego of man. And so you can think of the ego man and the ego God, and spell ego in each case with a capital E. Because the ego man is just the reflection of the ego God. God is the ego of man. The ego man is the image and likeness of perfect mind, spirit, divine principle. These terms come in this beautiful close relationship one with another in this chapter. And the one ego, our ego, man's ego, his mind, his spirit, is infinite individuality, which individually we reflect. This infinite individuality or indivisibility of mind, spirit, the one ego, is reflected in individual spiritual man and things.